This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Chicago's Millennium Park has been hailed as a 21st century landmark and a showcase for postmodern architecture. Opened two summers ago, it's been a huge success with visitors. But getting the park built was anything but smooth sailing for the city on the lake. There were critics and controversies, there were delays, and there was a big price tag. On the program today, we'll talk about public parks, public art, and the creation of Millennium Park with urban historian Timothy Guilfoyle. He is the author of Millennium Park, Creating a Chicago Landmark. The book is a history of the park's creation, and as the book's jacket describes it, it's also a biography of a phenomenal undertaking that resulted in the transformation of an unused railroad yard into a park, outdoor art museum, cultural center, and performance space. Timothy Guilfoyle is professor of history at Loyola University of Chicago. He writes a regular column for Chicago History Magazine. In addition to his book on Millennium Park, he is the author of City of Eros and A Pickpocket's Tale. The book Millennium Park, Creating a Chicago Landmark, is published by the University of Chicago Press. Professor Guilfoyle, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Celeste.
Your two daughters, Maria and Danielle, you note at the end of the book in your acknowledgments, they grew up with the park. What do they think of the park, and what are their favorite attractions?
Well, their favorite attractions are probably the skating rink. They're both young, aspiring figure skaters. My youngest, Danielle, is 7, and my oldest, Maria, is 10. And ever since the park, that part of the park opened, which was the first part of Millennium Park to be open to the public in 2001. We go there several times a month to go ice skating. In the summer, we don't make it down as much because we have other activities, but they do like the park grill to eat as well,
yeah.
Especially the chicken fingers for my youngest.
Yeah. It's such a popular park. It's a destination for tourists now. What would you like to tell us about what's struck you as you're at the park about how visitors experience it?
Well, I think perhaps that's a difficult question to answer, in part because the park has so many components that it's difficult to generalize on how so many people experience the park.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the themes that I've had in discussions with people both from Chicago and outside of Chicago. They often focus on completely different things. Many people like the garden, for example, because it has a certain kind of sedate quality to it. Many like the Great Lawn, in part because of the great sound and the vast open space that you have there virtually in the middle of the city. Others are entranced by Cloudgate or the Bean, as it's known. And then there's people like my children that just love to go there and play and ice skate or walk on water, as they say, at the Crown Fountain. So I think the park, one of the reasons the park has been successful is that it appeals to a variety of different constituencies and different groups in ways that I think perhaps even the planners of Millennium Park didn't quite anticipate.
Yeah. One of the key players in this process was a fellow by the name of John Bryan.
Uh-huh.
And he says about the park, it does something to the spirit of this city that almost is impossible to define.
Yeah, I think that's true. In many ways, Bryan's vision is what probably was probably the critical ingredient in creating Millennium Park. Originally, Mayor Daley asked him to raise $30 million to build a park on top of the then under construction garage. Bryan immediately went back to his office and told his aide, well, we'll double that. We'll raise at least $60 million. And by the time it was all over, he had raised over $230 million. And he had a particular vision about what he wanted at that site and was able to convince the mayor that it was worth striving for and persevering despite the various criticisms and the escalating cost over time. And that was probably one of the key, if not the key, factors in the evolution of the park from just really just a piece of grass with a few minor amenities to the kind of spectacular landscape that it is today.
Yeah. How did Brian, and there were others, of course, how did they, it seems clear that this park could not have been built the way it is without private support. How did they rally donors to their vision?
Well, there are a number of factors that explain that. I think perhaps the most critical is Brian himself. Brian is highly respected in both the corporate and philanthropic and really the artistic communities in Chicago. And he believed that Chicago needed some kind of landmark or structure to celebrate the millennium, much the same way that Paris has the Eiffel Tower or St. Louis, the Arch. He felt that Chicago needed some kind of identifying structure like that. And when the mayor asked him to raise the money for Millennium Park, he saw that as the opportunity to go after something like that. Brian had helped raise over roughly $100 million for the Chicago Symphony and the Lyric Opera in renovating their two institutions. And that established a track record for him. He was well known in the fundraising community. He's a very astute businessman, highly respected in the business community. He's also chairman of the trustees of the Art Institute. So he had his feet in all these different social, civic, philanthropic groups that allowed him to bring all these groups together at a particular time and convince them that this was a unique event, one that one should not pass up, a rare opportunity in the history of Chicago, and one that was going to define this generation of civic leaders and businessmen into the next millennium. And he was able to pull it off.
Hmm. It's a relatively small park, 24 acres.
24 acres, that's correct.
But it is a big statement. Is Millennium Park a departure from the grand urban parks of the U.S., parks like Central Park or Golden Gate Park or Grant Park, which it is an extension of, or should we see it as a new point on a continuum?
Well, I think it's more of a departure in several ways. First, you mentioned Central Park and Golden Gate Park, which were designed by Frederick Law Olmsted in the 19th century. Even some of the smaller parks, such as those designed by Jen Jensen and Alfred Caldwell and others in Chicago, were different than Millennium Park in that they followed a distinct, comprehensive design and were primarily the brainchild of one particular landscape architect. Millennium Park, by contrast, is really kind of a hybrid. I often like to say that it was planned by committees. Brian, when he was trying to generate support for the park, established a series of committees that dealt with different elements or what he referred to as enhancements in the park, and eventually approached different specialists in, say, sculpture and public art, different families that had some historic ties to Chicago, such as the Pritzkers and the Crowns, and asked them to make a specific contribution, whether it was in terms of their expertise about art or whether it was in terms of their financial support. And each part of the park then developed incrementally and differently over time. In many ways, the original plan looks nothing like what eventually was built in Millennium Park. And that wasn't the case with Central Park or Golden Gate Park. Those parks pretty much followed the same plan that was originally laid out by their master planner. Even Grant Park, which is different than Central Park or Golden Gate Park because it was largely an educational or associational park. It's a park that tries to educate anybody that comes into it in some way, in contrast to Central Park, which is kind of a respite or an escape from the city. Millennium Park doesn't follow the same pattern as the rest of Grant Park. In many ways, this was one of the key debates early on in the planning of Grant Park. The original designers, Adrian Smith of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, wanted the park to complete Grand Park in the tradition of the Beaux Arts style and the City Beautiful movement that was espoused by Edward Bennett, the main designer of Grand Park. And he wanted it to follow a more historic, traditional design. And even here, Brian departed from that history and wanted to set out in a new direction and try something that was completely different, something that would distinguish Chicago from other parks and distinguish Millennium Park from even Grand Park itself.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today about Chicago's Millennium Park with historian Timothy Guilfoyle. Listeners, you can join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I have a listener waiting on a cell phone on line one, so let's go ahead and take this call. Line one, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you for doing this particular program. I love listening to Afternoon Magazine, but I certainly love Millennium Park. I've watched that park develop from a place that we stay in Chicago frequently across the street on Michigan Avenue, and of course it's been a number of years. I've been in the park a number of times, and I can't tell you what my favorite feature would be, but I find that most people who don't live in the city don't seem to be too interested in going to see it. I mention it to people in my area, and they say, oh, that's nice. Well, if I have time, I'll go there. I think if you drive by, it's perfectly beautiful, but you really need to enter the park to appreciate it. So I guess I don't have a specific question, but how can we encourage the people in the rest of the state to just enjoy this unique and wonderful thing?
Well, I think the city and the Tourism Bureau are doing everything they possibly can to try and encourage people to go to Millennium Park. It is now the second largest tourist attraction in Chicago, attracting roughly 3 to 4 million visitors a year, and of course that includes area residents as well as people internationally. So I think people are going to the park. It might not be on everybody's radar screen, but I think that's slowly changing over time, and much of the literature you see on Chicago now often has images of Cloud Gate or the Pritzker Pavilion, which now in a sense have become somewhat iconic images of Chicago in the same way that maybe the Sears Tower or the Picasso sculpture in Daly Civic Plaza are today.
I want to thank the listener for her call, and we're going to take another call now, another listener on a cell phone, line four this time. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting. I joined a little bit late, so please forgive me if you guys already covered this. But I'm actually from Chicago, and I had two quick questions, and then I'll hang up and listen off the air. I was wondering if the straightening of Lakeshore Drive is what caused the park in the first place, the idea as to, okay, now what do we do with this land? Because my wife and I used to work in the Prudential Building right there, and I can remember, you know, when it was different. And then I heard you mention about Grand Park, and this is a little bit far afield, but historically, I heard before Chicago had an airport, they used Grand Park as an airport simply for the mail drops. And I didn't know whether or not there was any truth to that or if you had any background. And I'll go ahead and listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. The first question is very relevant. The museum campus, which was part of the development of the realigning of Lakeshore Drive at the southeast corner of Grand Park, was in some ways the model for Adrian Smith in completing Grand Park in the tradition of the Beaux Arts style, the City Beautiful movement. But more instrumental was simply the fact that the city was finally able to repossess this land in 1998. It had previously been controlled by the Illinois Central Railroad, and through a series of complex legal maneuvers, the city was able to regain control of the land. And originally, the garage at Millennium Park was designed as remote parking for Soldier Field. That was, in many ways, Millennium Park began as a kind of transportation project. There was going to be an intermodal transit center there. The IC Metro comes in there. There's the Randolph Street Station already in place. There's all the various underground tunnels that connect that part of Randolph Street with other buildings throughout the loop. And the park, in many ways, was kind of an afterthought to building the garage. Once the city realized that they could generate revenue that would support the bonds, they went ahead with building the garage, and the park kind of developed incrementally after that. So the museum campus was a model early on, but quickly was lost once John Bryan decided to go in a different direction. As to your second question, Grand Park was used briefly as an airfield back in the 1930s. I'm not sure if it was an airdrop for the airmail, but it was used as an airfield early on in the 1930s.
Very interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Timothy Guilfoyle, our guest this afternoon. We're talking about the creation of Millennium Park. And actually, questions about Grant Park are really very germane to this discussion, because Professor Guilfoyle does a very nice history at the outset of the book of Grant Park. And I think maybe we could talk a little bit about Grant Park. One of the things that you say is that by the end of the 20th century, Grant Park was Chicago's front yard. How was it that this large piece of property became reserved for public land, as public land? How did Grant Park become Chicago's front yard? It's a big story, but maybe you'd tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that has a long and complicated history. I'll try and be brief. The primary reason that you have a park on that strip of Chicago is that when Chicago was plotted in the 1830s, the canal commissioners of Illinois and Michigan Canal were responsible for dividing Chicago into lots. And on the map, they wrote that this part of the lakefront should be forever open, clear, and free of any buildings or structures. And that became the precedent for building Grant Park. Originally, it was called Lake Park or Lakefront Park, the strip from roughly just south of Randolph Street. The park wasn't very much during the course of the 19th century because the Illinois Central entered the city just off Michigan Avenue. And it wasn't until after 1901, when Lake Park was renamed Grant Park, that the city started filling in what is today Grant Park. Originally, Grant Park, as well as Millennium Park, was water. And over the course of the 20th century, Grant Park was filled in. And by the 1930s, it was essentially, even 1920s, was essentially complete, although various elements of it were still unfinished.
Yeah. Now, had the Columbian Exposition played a role in how people envisioned what should go along the lakefront?
Very much so. At first, in fact, there were plans led by Daniel Burnham to stage the exposition in Lake Park, or Lakefront Park, as it was then called. But there simply really wasn't enough space and enough support from the civic community, and so eventually that was moved to Jackson Park. But the Columbian Exposition served as kind of the inspiration for expanding Lake Park into Grant Park, and was really the model for the various designs and the streetscape that came to be Grant Park, and has pretty much remained the model. Occasionally there was a statue or an element of it that tended to be more Art Deco, but for the most part that kind of Beaux-Art style is what define Grant Park in the way it was designed and developed during the course of the 20th century.
Yeah. In 1894, we had a fellow on the Chicago City Council by the name of Martin Madden, and he envisioned a kind of a park, and he proposed filling in Lake Michigan east of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
What was his vision?
Madden was one of several people, including Daniel Burnham. We've forgotten Martin Madden, except for a few historians. We remember Daniel Burnham today.
Right.
But in many ways, I think Daniel Burnham has been a little bit overrated in terms of his influence on the creation of Grant Park. the plans that were in many ways became the plan of Chicago in 1909 was really a composite of ideas that were percolating throughout the 1890s and early 20th century. And there were a number of civic leaders and architects who wanted to build a large, great park just adjacent to the downtown area, what became known as the Loop, and serve as kind of the centerpiece or the focal point or the civic center of Chicago. And Burnham was the one that was eventually able to best articulate and bring these ideas together, both from with support of the architectural community and, most importantly, the business community in Chicago.
The debate over the creation of Millennium Park, does it at all mirror the discussion over the creation of Grant Park and the lakefront, what the lakefront should look like?
That's a good question. I think Millennium Park is a little different, primarily because of the role of the private sector in the development of the park. Most of Grant Park was designed by the city of Chicago, by various city agencies. One of the reasons the park was incremental and slow to physically develop was because oftentimes there simply wasn't enough funding available to complete certain elements of the park. Perhaps the best example of that is that there were numerous efforts throughout the 20th century to build a large music pavilion somewhere in the park, and they always failed for a variety of reasons, one of which was simply lack of funding and lack of immediate public support. By contrast, Millennium Park came to be primarily because of the influence of the private sector. And if the private sector had not been willing to donate such a large sum of money collectively, Millennium Park simply never would have developed, surely wouldn't have developed in the form that it took today.
Yeah. Now, that has also been a point of contention, of mm-hmm. some controversy, the private money, you know, naming rights and corporate underwriting and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
What's your take on that controversy?
Well, I think there's a number of ways of looking at it. I think some of the criticisms that people have raised about the role of the private sector have some legitimate merit. But I think in the case of Millennium Park, they ignore the larger picture, namely that this for over 150 years was largely privately used land by one of the largest and most powerful corporations in American history, the Illinois Central Railroad. Over the last 30 years of the 20th century, it was used largely as a rather unattractive parking facility with very little access on the part of the public to any part of the space. Now it is a public space in ways that it never was for 150 years. So I think in that regard, some of the questions don't, some of the criticisms don't really hold out historically.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if people who go to the park on a regular basis, if they think of the Boeing Gallery as just the gallery and the Exelon Pavilion as just the pavilion.
Well, that's a good question. I'm sure the sponsors of those particular enhancements would be upset to perhaps to hear that. But another element to the story that I think is sometimes misunderstood or forgotten is the history of both philanthropy and you might say the creation of culture in the United States. The fact is that the private sector does support large cultural activities and institutions. There's the Shedd Aquarium, the Field Museum, the Adler Planetarium in the southern end of Grant Park, and those are all named after rich millionaire businessmen. Institutions like that simply wouldn't exist without the largesse of the private, corporate, and philanthropic communities. Universities wouldn't be able to function, especially private universities, without that kind of philanthropy. And that's just the reality of philanthropy and culture in the United States. Americans simply don't want their tax dollars to be spent on large cultural projects. Those of us in the Academy may disagree with that and be critical of the emphasis on private philanthropy, but that is largely the history of cultural production, or one important element of the history of cultural production in the United States, that in a certain sense, Millennium Park is the embodiment of that history.
Mm. And you could point out that public radio... and it's, you know, the programming on public radio counts on the underwriters and listeners. I mean, it's a joint venture. But
much as we would wish that you would get larger public subsidies, this simply, unfortunately, doesn't happen.
Or we'd have more listeners contribute. Well, let's put that issue aside. You mentioned the site that had been a railroad yard, and you called it largely unattractive. I think that was kind of an understatement. There are many, many photos in the book, and I'm going to point to one that really points out how unattractive the future site of Millennium Park was. There was a photo taken in the 1970s at some point, and it's on top of everything else. It's winter, but it is really an eyesore.
Mm-hmm.
And then the city somehow discovered that the railroad didn't have complete ownership of this piece of property. It held title, but it didn't own it. How was that discovery made, and what did that ultimately mean?
Well, that's a good question, and that's one of the interesting, largely unknown stories about Millennium Park. There was a park district council by the name of Randy Mayerberg, who is now the general counsel and a vice president, I believe, at Exelon. But at the time, he was working for the park district. As an attorney, and he noticed that from his days when he had worked at Jenner and Block as a railroad attorney, that large numbers of railroad employees parked on the site and for free, and then walked to their offices in the loop. And he was kind of curious as to how they were able to do this. And so one day he walked down to the site and was looking around. The attendant on duty came up to him and said, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" Remember, explained that he was trying to learn more about the site and why people were parking there. The attendant actually reported him to Forrest Claypool, the park district commissioner at the time, the president of the park district, I believe, and they had to do a little investigation. But what Mayerberg then proceeded to do was investigate the legal background of the site and discovered, much to the surprise of many people, that the Illinois Central Railroad did not hold complete title to the land. They held title to the land and control of the land as long as it was used for railroad purposes. And the key words were railroad purposes. By this point, the Illinois Central was not using it for anything more than parking. Every year there was one track that remained on the site. They would run a rail car through the site just to claim that they were still using it for rail purposes. But the fact was that it was being used for something completely different. So the city brought this to court and then began initiated a series of negotiations between the Illinois Central and the city of Chicago that eventually led to the city reacquiring control over the site. And what's interesting is that if Randy Mayerberg had not been curious about the people parking on that particular site, Millennium Park never would have been built. He was the one that got the ball rolling. He was just curious about why railroad employees were allowed to park there, and the rest, you might say, is history.
Yeah, yeah. So was it that piece of news that then set the mayor in motion?
Very much so. The mayor, there's a story that's repeated by many of the people I interviewed, that the mayor used to go to his dentist, whose office overlooked that part of Grand Park, and he'd always look out the window and say, "Oh, isn't that terrible? We got to do something about that." And when he learned that the city was about to repossess the site, he immediately began plans to try and build a park or build something to cover what he considered an ugly eyesore. At the same time, there had been various plans floated by various agencies in Chicago to try and complete that part of Grand Park in some form or fashion. So there were really a number of forces going on prior to Mayor Berg's investigation. And when Mayor Berg and the city were able to repossess the land, that generated a more rapid response to try and build a garage and ultimately a park on top of the garage.
Yeah. Now, what was the vision in 1997, 1998 for that space other than the garage and a park on top of the garage?
Well, the Adrian Smith, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill was the individual that the city tapped to design something on top of the garage. Smith had been involved in some of the planning for remote parking at the site, had been involved in some of the plans for Soldier Field, and so he was an obvious person to tap for that particular task. And Smith was following, I think, perhaps two influences. One was the Beaux-Arts style and the plan of Chicago that was outlined by Edward Bennett and Daniel Burnham earlier in the semester that I mentioned earlier. But he also knew that there were restrictions on buildings, building heights in Grand Park. And so he developed a, comparatively speaking, modest plan with a music pavilion, a skating rink, a restaurant, a great lawn on the site. And the pavilion itself was kind of a sunken structure that did not go above the 47-foot elevation of Randolph Street. So it would not block any vista, any view of the lake from Randolph Street and very little from Michigan Avenue.
That was important to the folks across the street. at the same time, let's go back here for just a moment to Daniel Burnham, who said, "Make no small plans."
Mm-hmm.
And that sentiment then is echoed at some point in the process by these donors who are putting things into motion,
mm-hmm.
raising the money needed for the park. Marshall Field, the fifth, you quote him as saying the donors didn't want to put an ordinary park on that piece of land. They said, gee, if we're going to do this, then we've got to shoot for the moon.
Uh-huh.
So now we've got height concerns, but we want to do something really spectacular in a relatively small piece of real estate. Who did these folks call to the table in terms of planners and architects, artists?
Well, again, this was the strategy that that John Brine instituted, in part influenced by his success on raising $100 million for the symphony and the lyric. Brian decided to divide the park into enhancements, a water feature, a skating rink, a music pavilion, a garden, a peristyle, up a large promenade, and he would approach historic families and corporations that had long historic links to Chicago and ask them for a major donation to develop that part of the park, major being anywhere from $3 million to $15 million. He would then also approach other individuals and corporations to make a contribution of $1 million. And that was the minimum contribution for anybody who wanted to become a founder or a donor to Millennium Park. And this strategy ultimately was approved by the mayor as well. And so once he adopted that strategy, he then approached, for example, the Pritzker family and asked them for a large donation to develop the pavilion. He approached the Crown family and asked them for a large donation to develop the water feature. In the case of the Crown family, he actually gave them control over choosing the artist or the sculptor, the designer of the fountain. The Crown family actually had kind of a small internal competition where various artists presented plans for a water feature or a fountain. By contrast, when he approached the McCormick Tribune Foundation and the Wrigley Foundation to make contributions, those parts of the park were already designed, and they simply made a large donation and accepted the design as it was. So as a consequence, each part of the park went through a completely different process. Perhaps one of the ironies is that the first major contribution he had came from Pat and Shirley Ryan to develop a garden. And originally the Kapoor sculpture was going to be in the garden, and through a series of discussions they decided to move it to where it is now in the park. And at that point the Ryans felt that the park wasn't working out in the way that they had envisioned. They pulled their decided not to contribute the large donation that they were originally going to make. And so at that point Brian held a decided to hold a garden competition, and that became the only part of the park that was designed through the result of a large international competition. So as this is where I refer to the park being developed by committee in this kind of incremental fashion, because there was no single comprehensive plan. It was primarily the vision of John Bryan to approach it incrementally, and in some ways that allowed for more participation on the part of various donors and architects, designers, and sculptors in ways that probably wouldn't have happened if there had been a single comprehensive design, if there had been a singular vision by one landscape architect. It probably wouldn't have turned out quite that way.
Yeah.
Now, Brian worried throughout the planning of this that there was too much going on in the park, and one of the criticisms some people have had about the park, my favorite example is Fred Bernstein of the New York Times referred to it as a sculpture garden on steroids. And Brian was worried that having so many prominent artists and architects, Frank Gehry, Jaume Plensa, Anish Kapoor, Catherine Gustafson, all in such close proximity to one another, that in the final result, the artists would be, in his words, screaming at one another, that it wouldn't come together as a kind of singular design. And in the end, they felt that they were able to avoid that by the way they ultimately placed various enhancements in the park. But this was a concern early on in the planning of the park, that there was going to be too much going on in the park and that it wouldn't cohere in a coherent way.
Yeah. How do the artists see the end result?
I'm sorry?
How do the artists, those who, you know, Gehry and Kapoor and Plensa and Nickel and so on, how do they see the end result?
I think all of them are pretty happy about the results. I think many of them enjoyed working in conjunction with one another. One of the elements of Gehry's design that they admitted that they liked was that it kind of fit in terms of the metallic object of the bean and the metallic design of the Pritzker Pavilion. Plensa originally, I think, intended the Crown Fountain to be much more a place of repose and quiet. It turned into something much different than that, but he's just as happy about the fact that the park is so popular with children and with all the various people that come there to splash in the water. And for the most part, I think all of them have been very happy with the final product, that the different elements seem to cohere with one another in a variety of ways. When Gehry designed the BP Bridge, for example, he ended the bridge so that it coincided with the seam that Catherine Gustafson designed in Lurie Garden. So they were, in a sense, Gehry and Gustafson were working together to try and make those elements of the park seamless, in a sense, and work together. When Gustafson was designing Lurie Garden, she was well aware that Renzo Piano was going to be the designer for the new addition to the Art Institute. She actually tilted part of the Lurie Garden so that when Piano's building is eventually completed in several years, when you're on the upper floor of it, the Lurie Garden will serve as a kind of palette that you can look down on it onto it as if it were a painting. And so the various designers and artists were able to, in a sense, work with one another at various points in ways that I think they found unique in terms of the kind of work that they've done. Usually an architect builds a structure and it's that built in isolation, or a sculptor designs a particular piece of art. It's also in a certain sense of isolation. So this was a public project that allowed them to integrate their work with other artists simultaneously.
Mm. We have to wrap up here. Last question, though, I've got to ask you about Chicago. Early in the book, you say the forces that generated Millennium Park are a reflection of nearly two centuries of Chicago history, politics, and culture. And let's talk a little bit about history and culture here, and that is public art or art in public spaces. Chicago, it seems to me, maybe it's the city, the big city that I know best, but I love its public art, the Picasso, the works by Chagall that are in public space, the Bat Column, the Miro. This history with public art in public spaces, or art in public spaces for the public, did that help inform Millennium Park?
Yes, very much so. I think Chicago, especially people in the Park District and people in the artistic community, are very much aware of Chicago's tradition in promoting public art, and actually take a great deal of pride in the various stellar pieces of public art that are sprinkled throughout Chicago, and especially in the Loop. And in a sense, that kind of upped the ante a little bit in the case of Millennium Park, because they knew whatever they developed in Millennium Park was going to be compared with the Calder and the Chagall and the Picasso. Only a few blocks away. And so that was very much of influence on the part of planners. Again, Marshall Field's quote, to shoot for the moon, if they were going to do large, spectacular pieces of public art, they should try and attract the best artists in the world, the leading sculptors, the leading architects. And early on, when they were able to get the support and agreement of Frank Gehry to do the pavilion and the bridge, that had a kind of a ripple effect, that it encouraged other leading artists and landscape designers to become more involved in the park, because many people wanted to be able to work with Gehry or be involved in a project that involved Frank Gehry, whom many consider to be the premier architect at the turn of the millennium.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Guilfoyle, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
Very interesting. Timothy Guilfoyle, professor of history at Loyola University of Chicago. He is the author of Millennium Park, Creating a Chicago Landmark. The book is published by the University of Chicago. The University of Chicago Press. We got clipped off there. That interview from the WILL AM 580 archives. I'm Celeste Quinn. The interview we had scheduled for today, we've had to reschedule that, and we will reschedule that. We haven't yet had a chance to do that, but we will reschedule with Rodney Bolt about his book, The Librettist of Venice, The Remarkable Life of Lorenzo de Ponte, Mozart's poet, Casanova's friend, and Italian opera's impresario in America.